Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Welcome back, Fred. I know you've been busy all summer, and we're just in August, but what a summer it's been.
Yeah, it's been crazy. Weddings and you know, vacations, I have to admit. It's been nice, great to be back.
And we've had tremendous scientists on the show in the weeks that you've been out. So we've had a good run so far this summer.
It was a great run, but Bob, last week, you had Ray Comfort on.
Yeah.
That was so awesome.
His fourth appearance on Real Science Radio for his new film, The Atheist Delusion.
I haven't seen it yet, but man, his films are fantastic.
Yes.
They really drive the point home.
I got to watch a preview version, and I strongly recommend people listen to that interview from last week. Just go to rsr.org. I think you'll love the interview. And you know what was fun about the film, Fred? So many of the people in the film, well-known people, are people we've interacted with on this show, like Lawrence Krauss. He sat down with Lawrence Krauss. Well, Krauss has been on the show, and we had quite a program, and you and I really enjoyed that, then going through that. And Richard Dawkins, who we went to Oxford New College last fall. We tried to reach Dawkins. We didn't quite succeed, but we did put our Dawkins Evolution Challenge in his faculty inbox, a nice, beautiful four-color printout of our Dawkins Evolution Challenge. So he's seen it. And so since P.Z. Myers has responded to us, and Jerry Coyne, and all these, Phil Plait, all these various evolutionists and old earthers, maybe we'll get Richard Dawkins yet on the hook.
There you go.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. So 10 years ago, September 2006, we did our first list show. Real Science Radio is famous for our list shows and how fun they have been. So like our list of not so old things, list of evidence against the Big Bang, list of transient events in the solar system. We have list of genomes that just don't fit. We have so many fun list shows.
I can't believe it's been 10 years since we did this list show, and it's on the fathers of the physical sciences. Hard to believe it's been 10 years.
Because
time goes
so many,
by fast when you're having fun, Bob.
Yeah, it does. So we'll have to redo that.
Absolutely.
And get a brand new, state-of-the-art list of the fathers of the physical sciences. And what was fun about that, Fred, is so many of them are creationists. They believe that God is the one who created the earth and specially created Adam and Eve. And it's not only before Darwin, that's what a lot of atheists say, but there's also so many after Darwin. So before Darwin, we have Nicholas Copernicus, Francis Bacon, Johann Kepler, of course, Isaac Newton, and John Dalton, father of atomic theory. Then you have Darwin, and then after Darwin, you've got Michael Faraday, electromagnetism, and James Clerk Maxwell, and Louis Pasteur, and James Joule, Lord Kelvin, all these guys. So we'll go through this, and it'll be a lot of fun. I can't wait for that. So we didn't just mention the father of geology, but to do that, we are going to speak with a professor from Patrick Henry College. This is a Christian college. And the professor there who teaches some of the science courses, his name is David Lee, and he's got, I mean, this guy's a credentialed professor.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got a BS in geology from Clemson, which is a really great school in South Carolina.
Yep.
He also had a minor in biological sciences, but he also went to school just north of here up in South Dakota, a very good engineering school, the South Dakota School of Mines. It's right up in the Black Hills, really gorgeous.
Yeah,
area.
We have in Golden, Colorado, we have the School of Mines.
Yeah, Colorado School of Mines.
And we'll have to ask David how their football team did against our football team. But to get an MS in paleontology then from the South Dakota School of Mines, add that to the bachelor's in geology from Clemson University. Pretty neat. David teaches laboratory courses for biology, as well as upper-level science courses on origins and earth science. And with his background in life and earth sciences, just perfect for a Christian university. And what an honor now to go to Professor David Lee. David, how are you doing?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. We wanted to talk about, eventually, about what it's like to be a creationist student in a secular academic program. But do you think we could first start talking about the father of geology? Because before the program, Fred and I were talking about that, and we don't know all that much about Nicholas Steno. In fact, Professor Lee, could you be the teacher and Fred and I will be the students?
It works for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we could be a little dense sometime, okay? So, and we might ask obnoxious questions, but we'll do our best to behave.
That's completely fine. Questions are always encouraging, and they let me know that you're paying attention and not on Facebook or something. So that's very encouraging.
Sounds good. Fred, put your phone down.
Yeah, he already made me do the, you know, airplane mode.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. Yeah, Nicholas Steno is just a really fascinating figure in history, and he's not known by many as the father of geology. That title tends to go towards either James Hutton or Charles Lyell, but typically, depending on who you read, they're listed as the fathers of modern geology because they're the fathers of uniformitarianism,
right,
which, as I'm sure you've discussed on the show, the idea that the present is the key to the past.
Right.
Nicholas Steno was the father of geologic observation and several laws that are used today. And almost every student who takes an earth science or a geology course learns these same exact laws as he penned them way back in the 1600s. Yeah, so Nicholas Steno was actually originally trained as, I use trained loosely because he was practicing in the 1600s, where formal training in the sciences was very informal, if you will. He studied in a variety of different places, but he was originally from Denmark. His name was Niels Stenson, but he was eventually given the Latin name Nicholas Steno, which we know him by now. And he was an anatomist. He studied a lot of different facets of human and other animal anatomy. And he even has a few glands and ducts named after him. I'm forgetting which ones at the moment, but the word Steno is somewhere in there.
And I think stenographers are named after him. No, I'm sorry. I'm just cutting up in class.
But it was actually Steno's study of anatomy that led him to some really interesting conclusions with geology. At one point, there was a large shark. I'm not sure if it was a great white. I'm not sure if even they knew what species of shark. But a very large shark that flowed up on the shores of Italy, where he was living at the time. And he was called upon to dissect it. And at the time, dissections were a very public event. Mm-hmm. And so in doing this dissection, he made very detailed drawings of the teeth in particular, which I think we just missed Shark Week recently, which is unfortunate. But the shark teeth that he found bore a striking resemblance to these stones that people had been finding known as tongue stones or glossopetrae. It's just Latin for tongue stone. Mm. And they were finding these all over the place, all in the mountains and on the plains, very far from the ocean. And it was very curious to them, these look kind of like shark's teeth. But nobody had it in their mind to draw the conclusion that these were actually shark's teeth. It must have just been some sort of coincidence.
And so they found them on
mountains? He was among
mountains?
The first to actually formally describe them as such and to stand by that claim. And he was also fascinated by finding other types of fossils, such as seashells, at places that they had no business being, on mountaintops, for example. By the way, if anyone's interested in learning more about Nicholas Steno, there's a really, really good book called The Seashell on the Mountaintop that chronicles his life and his contributions very well.
Wow, that's so interesting.
That is
cool. Here, David, here in Colorado, on the border with Utah, mostly in Utah, we have Dinosaur National Monument. We've gone there a number of times. Right next to that is a huge private ranch, and homeschoolers and others excavated an allosaur skull, the world's most complete allosaur skull. I think it had all of its teeth, 98% complete. But in Dinosaur National Monument, we call it Clam National Monument because they have way more clams than they have dinosaur bones, and they acknowledge that. And so around the world where you have all kinds of fossil graveyards, you have marine creatures mixed in with land creatures. That seems to be a common characteristic of fossil graveyards.
Absolutely. Like you said, that's common all over the world.
It's
and
it's Home
been
Depot.
All the way back before the time of Christ,
now,
even.
Now, David, Fred just said...
places that they had no business. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you can go to Home Depot or Lowe's and you'll find marine fossils in the gravel.
In the gravel.
That's true. Yep.
That is so
right.
Cool. Wow. And earlier, Fred had said about the shark teeth, do you find those at elevation? Do you find those at higher elevations, or I'm not sure the answer
tongue stone?
To that.
I'm not sure of the distribution of them, but they're pretty well intermixed. from what I understand. They're mixed in with the fossil fish bones and things like that. Mm. Because again, you know, sharks being fish, just very unique fish, they would have been pretty well distributed throughout, and they would have been common enough that people would be very familiar with them mm. in Italy. So while I can't remember the exact distribution of them, they would be fairly ubiquitous.
But it kind of drew his attention to geology from anatomy because of really this really kind of out of place. You don't expect him to find them, you know, on the shore, right? Hmm. But you're finding them elsewhere.
Yeah.
Is that what drew him to geology?
It was. Yeah, that was definitely one of the main contributors. He had a lot of various interests. He was very much a Renaissance man. A lot of different things, you know, some of his earliest sketches of snowflakes. He just studied all kinds of different things. Really fascinating guy. But this drew his attention to why it is that we see fossils in places that they have no business being. What is it that the Earth can tell us about the past? And this is something that hadn't really been much consideration up to this point, maybe in the minds of a few people over casual discussions. But for the most part, the Earth was sort of considered the stage on which humanity's play was performed. The stage's structure was of very little consequence or importance to people. But he started wondering, what's going on with the stage? Mm. How did the stage get here? What contributions were made to it? And so through a variety of different observations, he was actually able to construct the first regional geologic history of an area in Tuscany. And in doing that, he did so from a creation model. It's in a creationist worldview. And he framed it within the context of the worldwide flood of Noah's day. And it's just really fascinating that to go all the way back to the very foundings of geology, you have to deal with this figure who was very outspoken about the fact that Genesis mattered a great deal to the history of what he was studying.
Nicholas Steno.
He took it very seriously.
And the fact that he called it the stage, I love that personally because my life's work is a book on the Bible. It's an overview of the Bible. It's called The Plot. And sales of The Plot have kept us on the air for 25 years now. And the sequel to that is The Script, which is about halfway done. And then the plan to complete the trilogy is The Stage. And The Stage the Earth. And in fact, not only the Earth, but the solar system, the Milky Way, the universe, the stage that the events in God's word unfold. And even including heaven, in fact, in God's throne room. I love that, The Stage. And I also love what you pointed out, David, that when you go back to the early years of geology, you've got to deal with what was called flood geology. I don't know if you know the name of Dr. Terry Mortensen. He's got a PhD in the history of geology from Coventry.
I do, yeah.
You know of Dr. Mortensen?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he's just great. Coventry University in England. And he has helped so many people understand the history of geology, and the world's oldest scientific organization is the Geological Society of London. And what is so interesting about that group is that they weren't primarily scientists, they were lawyers. And they were lawyers who hated the idea of a Christian worldview, and especially a monarchy. They were anti-monarchist, and they thought if they could remove the notion of a divine right of authority, then they could undermine the monarchy. And so they loved the idea of the earth being millions of years old. So these lawyers manipulated the Geological Society of London to reject everything that was geological science to that point and go with Charles Lyell and Hutton and all this uniformitarianism, and they really just tossed out a tremendous amount of fabulous science.
Yeah, real science.
Absolutely. And it was foundational science, not only a separate school. It was foundational to what Hutton and Lyell did.
Do they
Without
still
Steno's work, they wouldn't have really been able to make the observations that they were able to make and then, you know, misinterpret them the way that they did.
Are there still principles that Steno taught or wrote about that are taught today in the secondary
school? There are, absolutely.
Oh, really? I bet you professors aren't talking about him being a biblical creationist.
No, that rarely comes up. But his contributions to the field of stratigraphy were, again, foundational. he came up with the first three laws. There are, you know, depending on who you read, five or more laws of stratigraphy, which
David,
is the study of rock layers.
There's superposition, right? And at the margins, that's been challenged. But could you explain those laws to us?
Sure, absolutely. Superposition is basically the idea that things are deposited one on top of the other rather than one underneath the other, that there is an order to rock layers and that it makes sense. So if you think about making pancakes, you're going to make a dozen pancakes because you're very hungry. You take the first pancake off, you put it on the plate, then you make a second pancake, and then you set it on top of the first one. You're making a tall stack of pancakes. Essentially, superposition states that the oldest pancake is going to be the one on the bottom, and the youngest pancake is going to be the one on the top. And it's the same with rock layers, because they have to be deposited in order. Now, there are obvious exceptions to this. I could take the stack of pancakes and I could flip it over. I could upend it. But in geology, there are different ways that you can determine which way is up. But originally, everything was deposited in a horizontal way and in a logical order, with the oldest stratum being on the bottom and the youngest being on the top. And so in this case, he wasn't actually arguing for long periods of time in there. He thought that these layers were deposited by the flood. But the fact that the youngest ones, even just by a few minutes or hours, would be deposited above the ones below them was foundational and helps make, essentially, that principle applies in archaeology, paleontology, any field where you're studying layers of anything, even if you were to study pancakes, I suppose. And that would apply there as well.
Yeah. Now, at our website, rsr.org/stratification, this is just sort of a rabbit trail for a moment. I did an interview just maybe 3 years ago with a French scientist. By looking at his name, we would say Guy Berthault, but I think they say G. Bucthou. But at any rate, up in northern Colorado, we have a hydraulics lab, Fred. You know,
Colorado State.
Yeah. And he came over here with some scientists. And David, they did the most amazing experiments. And we have three videos embedded on that page, rsr.org/stratification. And they took this very expensive, this is like a multi-million dollar lab, and a huge flume for fast running water. And they put all kinds of typical mineral sediments in, and they just run it around the flume at rapid speed, and they are forming simultaneously multiple strata. And even if you see strata on an incline, like a 45-degree angle, even strata, horizontal strata and incline strata, depending on, you know, what's below the flow. So anyway, I'd love to send you a link. And Fred, I don't know if you recall if you've seen those videos.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just awesome.
Very interesting.
So
very well presented.
It doesn't change the fact that if you go to the Grand Canyon, which we've gone to a dozen times, we've camped and rafted there. But when you look at the red wall limestone at the bottom, 500 feet thick, that obviously that was laid down before the layers near the rim. Obviously. Mm. But there are,
right,
at the margins, there are places in the world where when the flow of water was fast enough and there were enough sediments held in suspension that they were falling out and forming, rapidly forming stratus simultaneously. So at least that's a new development that's worth considering. You know, how does that help us understand mm-hmm. the world we live in? But that's a rabbit trail.
Oh, no, that's a fascinating rabbit trail, though, because I'm very interested to see the videos. Again, this is a bit of news to me, but it confirms what we know about the flood. It confirms that large amounts of sediment can be deposited very quickly, even finely laminated layers. And another great example of a way that we can see these deposited quickly is by looking at the deposits from Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens had a pyroclastic flow just tear through the side of the mountain and the countryside and deposit these very fine, thin laminae that if we were to come back and look later without any prior knowledge, geologists would assume were deposited gradually over many, many years. But we know that they were deposited within a few hours. some of them within a few minutes.
And you're talking about some of these.
If they fly laterally, then we can essentially play with the time constraints of the law of superposition.
Yes, and David, you're talking about some of these microstrata that in an inch or two, you might have 10 or 12 or 15 different layers. And these are happening even though these sediments are being deposited in air, basically, but the same effect happens in water. So when they would tell us every single layer has to be at least an annual layer, some of them every 10 years, every 100 years, every million, turns out that's not true. We can demonstrate in the lab and in the lab of the world that we live in with photographic documented evidence that these strata can be laid down rapidly.
Yeah, we had the great that example of all those jellyfish that were in, what, a million years worth of strata?
Oh, in Wisconsin. I don't know if you've heard about those, Professor Lee, but in one quarry, they had six layers of strata that they had been saying were laid down over a million years, and there was a school of jellyfish, a single school of jellyfish fossilized through all six layers. Which is powerful evidence that they were all laid down in one event.
Absolutely.
So
that's absolutely the case. Yeah. And there are plenty of examples of that. You know, you've got trees that are buried upright with several layers between them where you would think otherwise these layers were deposited very slowly and gradually, except that this tree couldn't survive millions of years. Slow, gradual deposition. It had to be deposited quickly in a vertical sense. The tree, not the layers.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's a really great time to be studying geology from a creation model because there are just so many confirmations of what Scripture tells us. And it's very encouraging to be studying it now. I imagine 20 or 30 years ago, there wouldn't have been near the wealth of information that we have now confirming the creation model because, frankly, people weren't studying science from the creation model, at least not in any large contributions. But we have that today, and it's again, it's a really fascinating time.
Well, let me give two more quick examples. You have an 80-foot baleen whale fossil, and it is inclined, and it's in a diatomaceous formation, dead diatoms. And the diatoms, there's hundreds of layers of diatoms. And the old Earth geologists would say that they took thousands of years for those layers, annual layers and even slower. And here's this whale fossil. That whale fossil had to be there for like 300,000 years while those diatoms were
somehow
deposited.
Somehow it just didn't decompose.
Yeah.
Must be the iron.
Right.
the iron in the bones. And they literally document whale carcasses decomposing today. And they see how rapidly they decompose. Very rapidly. In a few years, there's nothing left. So that's all a lot of fun. Could we talk a bit? We have a couple other science questions for you, David. But first, Patrick Henry College. Could you tell us about it?
Absolutely. Patrick Henry College is a private Christian liberal arts college located in Purcellville, Virginia, which is about an hour west of Washington, D.C. And it's a fascinating school for anybody interested in liberal arts and government and anything like that, any type of classical liberal arts emphasis. And as part of that, we highly emphasize the sciences, the natural sciences in particular. And so I teach biology there. I also teach earth science. And I have a course dedicated to origins, which explores the astronomy, geology, and biology, as well as the biblical interpretation of the origin of life and of the earth. Patrick Henry College is just a fascinating school, just a really great place to teach, top-of-the-line students. I couldn't ask for better students.
Wow, that's so great.
It's been a real honor.
And I think homeschoolers often look at Patrick Henry as an option. And
they do.
We're a homeschool family. Our three youngest boys, teenagers, our 18-year-old just graduated. He and his 16-year-old brother, they just did the ACTs, the SATs, and they're like 85 percentile of the whole country. And that's of the students who are college bound, who are taking the ACTs and the SATs.
Wow.
So my wife, Cheryl, good job, Cheryl, for teaching the kids and to do 30 percentile better than the nationwide public schools.
Well, you got a pretty solid set of schools out there in Virginia. Liberty's nearby, right? I mean, a couple of really good schools. I wish we had school like that here. My son checked out Liberty. I went out there with him. But, you know, he just decided he didn't want to be that far away, so he ended up going to CSU. But if there was a Liberty or a Patrick Henry in Colorado, it would have been a different story.
And, Fred, your son is studying the Bible. He's just going through it like nobody's business. He's just such a neat young guy.
Thanks.
Yeah, what a wonderful family you have. And we spend half of each show, David, bragging about each other's families. So, Patrick Henry, if you're a Christian homeschool kid, you believe that God created us, you go to Patrick Henry, everything will be great. It'll be fun. It'll be challenging. But how about you, when you attended, you go to a school of mines, and that's not going to be a young earth school. The South Dakota School of Mines is a prestigious school, but what's it like to be a creationist in a secular academic program?
It's very interesting. Again, I can only have the best things to say about South Dakota School of Mines, top-notch education, but again, it's conventional. It works within the existing paradigm of an old earth and naturalistic evolution. And so in studying there from a creation perspective, there was an awful lot of essentially learning to choose your battles. And there's, I think, maybe a mentality that students have when they go to college that they want to have sort of maybe the God's not dead moment where they get to show up the professor in front of the class.
Right. I love that film.
Because freshmen know more than tenured professors in many cases. No, it's sort of, not to say anything negative about the film, of course, but it's, we tend to think we're going to go out and get the world by the tail, when a lot of times the most valuable thing that we can do is be good students, is be meek. And it's what I spent a good bit of time doing. I actually did tell my advisor and the department head upon first meeting that I was a creationist.
Wow, good for you. Wow.
And I was advised to do that. I wasn't excited about it because I didn't know what would happen.
And other creationists, David, other creationists will go under the radar and they'll just, you know, attend. And when they ask you about the Big Bang or whatever, you just give them the answer they're expecting. So you know the material. But then you get your PhD and you go on to change the world. But so anyway, that was pretty cool that you let them know you're a creationist.
Well, you know, at CSU, my son took a geology class, and the very first question he asked, he handed out a piece of paper. I just have one question. How old is the Earth? That was the question he was asked at CSU in geology.
Yeah, right, because right away they're going to identify who the Christians are.
Yep. So he answered it truthfully, and he's a good student. Got an A in the class. I told him I was shocked you got an A in that class after answering
that. That's great. Our 15-year-old, now 16, he's gone to Red Rocks for a year. Taking a full load at Red Rocks this year as a 16-year-old, going homeschool and community college. I tell you, the teachers, every assignment early on was to figure out what is the worldview of these students.
Yep.
So they ask them about global warming and gun control and all this stuff. So at any rate, David, that's pretty cool how you approach that. I'm just curious. You said someone advised you. Who would advise you to do that? That's a gutsy thing to do.
Well, a very gutsy guy advised me to do that. A man named Marcus Ross. He's a professor at Liberty University. And he was also an alum.
We interviewed that guy.
South Dakota School of Mines.
What, Fred?
Didn't we interview that? I know we did.
Oh, is he a paleontologist, David?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, we had him out to Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, and we interviewed him before he gave his talk.
That's exactly right. Back in the fall.
Wow.
Back in the fall, Marcus Ross was here in studio. That's right. That's cool. So it's a small world, and it's a young world after all. Well, that's neat that he gave you that advice. That is really just great.
It is. I don't know how many people that are listening, how many people in your audience are high school, college age, but the best advice that I can give to them is to swim against the stream, to go against the current of what culture is telling you today, specifically with regard to having a mentor. It is vitally important, especially if you're studying science from a Christian worldview. This is very turbulent waters, if you will. And if you think, if you go about thinking that you can handle all of it on your own and you don't need somebody who's more experienced to talk to you and to guide you, I would just encourage you to reconsider that, because the younger generations value novelty and they seem to despise despise antiquity. And I think that it's really important that we look and say, for those who have been there, they know what pitfalls, you know, you're going to encounter. You don't have the benefit of the hindsight that they have unless you hear it from them. So, again, I would just strongly encourage anybody who's studying science that finding a mentor may not be trendy, it may not be popular, but it's vitally important.
You know, Bob, we're about out of time, but yeah. I'd like to ask Professor Lee's opinion on the order of the fossil record.
Oh, yeah, that is so interesting. So when we look in the Earth, Professor Lee, we see fossils, and the old earthers, evolutionists, tell us that's the order of Darwin's tree of life.
Right. What we're seeing is a fossil succession of different organisms throughout time. And we have a lot of gaps to fill in when studying fossils. And your worldview is it's inevitable. Your worldview will play a role in the way that you interpret the fossil record. So obviously from the naturalistic evolutionary perspective, what we're looking at is the evidence of evolution through time. And you even see some things, large scale, that may seem to confirm that. You see invertebrates showing up first, and then you see things like fish, and then you see tetrapods, things that crawl around on four legs. And then eventually you get to dinosaurs, another branch has mammals, so on and so forth. But when studying it from a creation model, I think that it's really important to make sure that we're not talking past one another. There's sort of a trend, I think, within the creation community, not as a whole, but I've noticed in some cases, to sort of fight yesterday's giants, to say that we know an argument that has worked in the past, and we know that there's an opinion that people have had that we want to address, but it may not be the most up-to-date. And that's why I think shows like this are so important, is because you don't just sit around, you know, rehashing evidence from, you know, 20 years ago that still works. You're talking about cutting-edge stuff, brand new research, brand new exploration that's going to confirm the biblical model. But what we see with the creation community is a lot of times the conversation is framed around how long a fossil takes to form. And I think that's really the wrong part to focus on. While that may be a component of what people are wondering about, the large-scale structure of the fossil record is really where the evolutionary community hangs its hat with regard to fossils. And so I was in the bookstore with a friend of mine who was an evolutionist, and he was explaining to a young child how a fossil formed, because this child had asked him.
Right.
And he didn't explain to him that, oh, well, over a very long time, it sat there, you know, on an open plain and was eventually covered by wind-blown sediment. He said, no, fossil only forms under very specific conditions. It has to be covered very quickly by sediment. It has to be kept from being picked apart by scavengers and rotting and things like that. And then in certain conditions, if it's covered quickly enough, it can become a fossil. And I think that the creation community can really learn from that, that it's not that people concede that it takes millions of years to form a fossil. It's that they think millions of years of history is recorded in fossils. So I think that that's, even before we get into what the order tells us, the fact that we're both talking about the order of the fossil record, I think, is really important. And so what we can see within the fossil record is different organisms being preserved in different places. But what's interesting is that we see certain organisms that seem to be preserved all throughout. We already mentioned earlier, fish, shark fossils being preserved all throughout layers, even layers where they have no business being, like among dinosaurs, in mountaintop regions. We have to have some sort of explanation for that. And the creation model has a really good explanation of the worldwide flood. The entire world was covered in water and torrential downpour, and we've got major motion, not just of water, but also of sediment, layers being deposited very quickly. It would make sense that we wouldn't necessarily see different organisms through time as if they had evolved, but that we would see different organisms through time in the order that the flood buried them.
Wow.
There's really good evidence that we've seen that.
So the whole geologic column, which is claimed to be hundreds of millions of years in duration for it to be laid down, could be viewed as the sediments laid down in a global flood, and the order of the fossils then are the order that the animals were eventually buried.
Absolutely. As they're gradually being buried, there are different environments that are going to be preserved. So if you look very far down in the fossil record, you're going to see the sudden, what's known as the Cambrian explosion, of all kinds of different types of life that seem to have arisen all at once. And it's a big problem for the evolutionary model. But within the creation model, that helps us indicate this is where the flood began, because all of these shallow marine creatures would have been deposited very quickly and for the first time. So we would see them in the rocks for the very first time. Again, going back to superposition, where the rocks at the very bottom are the oldest.
David, you may have heard of the book Darwin's Doubt by Dr. Stephen Meyer. We've had him on the show a couple times. And what's interesting is that those lowest fossils are basically bottom dwellers, you know, trilobites and worms and the things that the low-lying lakes, streams that were first filled with sediment, they got killed first. And so that's what you would expect at the bottom of a flood sediment. But let me make one other observation. Fred and I made a prediction. We've made a lot of science predictions on the show. And let me toot our own horn for a moment. Many of them have been confirmed. One of the most recent ones confirmed is we predicted that no matter how far down you are in the geologic column, they will find original biological material that's not yet fully decomposed. So the journal Nature Communications this summer, June 2016, published a report of gunflint chert that's allegedly 1.9 billion years old. Billion with a B.
Wow.
And they said, golly. No, they didn't say golly. But they found original proteinaceous material that had not yet been fully decomposed. And that's on top of another paper in the Journal of Paleontology where they found beard worms that still, they're allegedly 530 million years old. So we're talking Precambrian. And they still have original biological material not fully decomposed. So, David Lee, we considered those confirmations of our prediction that the old Earth geologist would never in a million years make that prediction, but there it is.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. And like I said, this is just a fascinating time to be studying Earth history from a creation model because we continue to find these confirmations. It's really fascinating.
So you talked about those creatures on the bottom in the fossil record. What would happen if you keep going up the column?
So as you keep going up the column, you would continue to find more and more creatures that were buried in different environments inland. And so instead of, and this theory goes back to the mid-1800s, called the ecological zonation theory. And this is the idea that the different strata actually represent different environments rather than a faunal succession through time. And so what we're seeing is instead of the gradual evolution, because there are several different places where the order of evolution doesn't match the order of the fossil record. In fact, it's very common for the order to be backwards. But if we look at the environments that are being preserved, we see things like you said, trilobites, things that live on the bottom of the ocean. And then eventually we see more reef-type creatures, corals, mollusks. And then we get to the swimming creatures, things that are living in the water column. So sharks, different types of fish, some of which we don't really have anymore that we know of, at least.
Sure. Many creatures went extinct during the flood. The Permian extinction, they call it.
That's right. Many of the extinction events that we see from an evolutionary perspective are really just different chapters of the flood being concluded. We see these fossils being deposited for the last time, and then we see new fossils being deposited. And so, as you mentioned, the end Permian mass extinction, we see that 90% of marine species that lived in the ocean, were wiped out at that point. The ones that we see before that in the fossil record, we don't see them anymore. And that 70% of terrestrial species die out. This is the largest mass extinction event that we see throughout history, but it fits within the context of the flood.
And it seems like the higher you go up in these layers or ecological zones, the more scarce the fossils become. I know it's like if you find a vertebrate fossil, it's rare and it's worth money.
Like most of the fossils are clams, right?
Yeah, and you can find those anywhere. But as you get higher up, it just seems to me, you know, it's more scarce. Mm. You know, mammals are going to be able to, you know, they're higher up, they're going to try to run and this and that. They're not going to, maybe there's just going to be a lot less of those mammals buried. That's my impression.
And so the percentage of fossils that are marine fossils, I don't have the exact percentages in front of me, but it's something like 90-some percent are marine. The vast majority of those are clams, and and the vast majority of those are invertebrates. Then, like you said, Fred, far fewer land animals, and then mammals, very few. And then eventually you look for human beings, and it's not surprising that there are very few human fossils. But whenever they've been found, they just get discarded because it's claimed, well, this can't be because human fossils can't exist. The Permian extinction, there was a report not long ago that this is in a major peer-reviewed journal, that the Permian extinction was a rapid event. I so enjoyed reading that because, you know, to the geologist, everything takes millions of years, and they were studying the chemistry of the sediments in the oceans. And they realized, I think by looking at isotopes, that this had to be a very rapid extinction. They weren't talking about a one-year global flood, but to them, this very long epoch was brought down to a very narrow sliver of time.
That's right, and the smaller the window, the more problematic it is from a naturalistic perspective. Mm-hmm. How did all these species get wiped out so quickly?
Wow.
If they gradually get wiped out, then that makes sense. That happens within their model. But the more quickly they get wiped out, the more of a problem that it is. You have to start looking for explanations. What changed? Mm. Absolutely.
So then we're up to the fish, and then you get to the land animals, and Fred has described those. And in fact, a geologist with the Institute for Creation Research, Henry Morris's group down in Dallas, ICR, Tim Clary, he is building a database of strata from all over the world. It's never before been done. It's a historic accomplishment that ICR is creating. And he is pointing out that the slow lumbering dinosaurs, you find them in different strata than the dinosaurs that are way more nimble and ever able to run faster. They survived the flood a bit longer than the others.
Absolutely. Yeah, we see some of those changes, and then we even see record of footprints being preserved before the creatures that bear the footprints by millions of years.
We got them right over here, right up the hill, right? Right, Bob?
Yeah.
Dinosaur Ridge.
Dinosaur Ridge just west of us, like 4 minutes.
Yep. Dr. Ed Holroyd frequently gives talks up there.
Yeah.
I think he works for the government, so they're probably, I don't know if they know about him giving a creation perspective on it.
Right.
But, you know, it's these footprints of dinosaurs, and they're running uphill. First of all, why are they running, and why were they preserved running?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, normally footprints are gone pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, why would they be preserved so quickly? They would have been, footprints don't stick around very long, especially in the type of sediment that you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, there's all of these different things where it just makes sense within a worldwide flood. And so, like I said, it's just really encouraging. We keep finding more and more confirmations of it.
And then you get to the top and you get birds, and birds would have survived the longest because they could fly. And the ones that succumbed, they end up in the floodwaters. And, of course, in the floodwaters, their bodies get torn apart. And so it's the geologic column is a record of the deposition of the global flood.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's Absolutely. Very encouraging. And Professor David Lee, I'm so thankful that you're there at Patrick Henry College, because all these young people who are preparing themselves for a life of making an impact on the world we live in for the Lord, and also just to have a great marriage and a great family mm-hmm. and raise kids who love the Lord,
mm-hmm.
I'm so thankful that you're there and the rest of the faculty, and that you guys are not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, nor of the Bible from Genesis, from the first chapter through to the last chapter of the New Testament.
Absolutely. It's truly an honor to be part of this college. And like you said, it's not just people studying science. It's people that are going to be going into government, people who are going to be making policy based on these things. And it's mm-hmm. vitally important that in all different areas of society that we have a good understanding of origins.
Amen. Well, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Professor Lee. This was awesome.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And so, Fred, it's great to have you back in that seat.
It's good to be back, Bob. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, I had a lot of fun vacations.
Yeah.
Some, you know, interesting weddings, I'll have to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely glad to be back.
Yeah. So that's super. And until our next program, this is Bob and Fred for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.